Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the In The Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes. So today's podcast is the first in a new series of interviews with interesting people, mostly probably going to be from around Lancaster University, but wider circles as well. Today we've got the remarkable Raphael Sava, whose work on corporate governance, corporate social responsibility is one, fascinating, and two, could change the world for the better, I think, anyway. So without further ado, we'll let Rafa introduce himself.
Hey everyone, my name is Raphael. I am currently a PhD candidate at Lancaster University. Fortunately, I will finish this year, but we'll see how that goes. And my main area of expertise comes into the realm of corporate law, corporate governance, and issues related to corporate social responsibility. What's corporate governance?
Should we outline sort of how corporate law regulates companies in general?
Or maybe even say, describe what that is. I think we need to go right to the very beginning here. So yeah. What is corporate law? And
absolutely.
What does it mean?
Yeah, I mean, corporate law in general is the law related specifically to the operation of the companies. How companies operate, the principles upon which companies operate, and issues related to the governance of the company, as in what the duties of directors are, how they are going to undertake their own filing and all, and issues related to what happens when the company goes bust, as in what happens on insolvency or any insolvency arrangements or anything like that. Now, corporate governance is just one part of that whole area called corporate law, and it deals specifically with the systems, rules, and principles that have to do with the regulation and governance of the companies. Because governance of the companies is not just a legal thing, it's an economic, it's accounting, it's pretty much everything. Everything that you guys deal with every day that you see in the news, and you probably deal with companies every day.
Okay, so stupid question, just to get started.
Yeah,
so
no stupid questions.
No. Well, when you say corporate, does this apply to businesses of all sizes, or is it from a certain size up?
Corporate governance, that's a very good question, because corporate governance ideally should apply to any kind of a company.
Right.
Every kind of company, even in my own practice, you see companies struggling with their own governance structures because pretty much people don't know how to run companies. The thing is that as you go up the scale, as in bigger the company, the more professional they are, they're not. The problem with corporate governance is always who controls and how he controls the corporation. No matter how professional he is, it's all about the system that works there. So even if we deal with a small company or a big company, it's pretty much the same thing. You just see a number of issues through a different lens with regards to the size.
Okay.
So that's quite interesting, because you said that corporate governance, whether the company is small or large, generally corporate governance remains the same size.
Well, some of the principles don't apply readily on small companies.
Right, okay.
For example, you're not going to regulate a small family company like a bakery, for example, in the same way as you're going to regulate Adidas.
Yeah, okay,
go on. But regardless of that, corporate governance as a system of rules has to apply in small companies as well. In fact, the UK government is undertaking regulations and consultations and creating corporate governance rules for small companies, taking into account issues related to small companies, as in what happens if a company is a one-man person company?
Mm.
What happens if the company is just a family firm? What if the whole family company is just one big family arrangement that extends to company, especially if the business is incorporated?
So
stuff like that need to be regulated. I don't deal with small companies, I deal with big public companies, but that does not mean that corporate governance should not extend to small companies.
Yeah, I suppose it's difficult to kind of to make a dividing line on the type of company, because, well, generally a family business is quite small, but you see kind of Trump International, that's technically a family business in some ways.
Well, they do get quite big. Even private businesses can get quite big, as in not listed on the stock exchange.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, actually the difference in the UK at least is that we have private companies and public companies. That's a big leap. That was one of the biggest, you know, innovations that UK law had to offer 100 years ago, actually. And having private companies, it means that, you know, small businesses can actually engage on an incorporated level and do business, because the company is a good thing. Contrary to many arguments that say the opposite, that, oh, the companies are for the big capitalists or anything like that, imagine how many firms are actually saved by corporations. Yeah?
How do you mean?
Well, say that a certain company is a family company.
Yeah.
And it runs successfully and everything like that. And it does involve to take a number of risks. Yeah, it has to do with taking a lot of risks, taking loans, paying a lot of people, paying employees, and unfortunately, not all businesses thrive. Yeah, should you destroy the family and condemn it for itself for its own debts because some business didn't function well?
Now, this brings up an interesting thing that I've seen in the news recently, because there's been a lot. I don't know if you know about phoenixing.
Yes,
this concept where essentially a business will run up a lot of debt, then essentially they'll file as bankrupt, shut down, but then they'll restart up essentially under a slightly different name, but with exactly the same people and same structure, with all their debts cleared.
Yeah, that's illegal. That's illegal. That, it's specifically stated at the Companies Act that it's illegal. It's illegal to have a Phoenix company. The issue with Phoenix companies is what we name as a Phoenix company. It comes as on the evidence and stuff like that that you deal with Phoenix companies. How do you determine some company to be a Phoenix company? And it has to do, I think, more with insolvency law stuff. This is not exactly my area. I mean, my area of expertise is when the company is still solvent. Like, it's up and running.
until it runs out of money.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, because I was just thinking, because of the responsibility with the Phoenix, and really you'd say, well, there should be a responsibility of you not to keep on exploiting the general public, as it were, and basically running up debts and creating a sort of boom-bust cycle.
Well, that comes with the principle of why the company should exist in the first place. As in, there is a good theory. It's called the concession theory, where, you know, it gives you, where the state gives you the whole corporate personality thing, and therefore the state has some element of, no, not the state, the company has some element of responsibility to the state as to its factions and stuff like that. Well, we traditionally think that corporations are therefore just profit maximizing. And that comes to a general idea of what is the purpose of the company? Is it just for purely maximizing profit, or is it something broader?
Right. I suppose that goes down to kind of the philosophical level of why people... links with business, but also kind of why people get collectivism as well.
Well, let's say from practical terms, say that we have a very big company. Let's just name Adidas, since we took Adidas, yeah? I'm going to name you a very practical example. Adidas, if it was going to run on profit, it will find the most cost-effective way of making shoes and sell it to you. Instead, what they have done, have you listened about the Run for the Oceans campaign?
Run for the Oceans. Not heard about that one.
Well, there is a certain line of Adidas shoes, I think they are the X-Boost, that are being made from materials that are collected by the oceans.
Ah, so you mean like rubbish that's
rubbish, lying around? Rubbish, right. Recycling, and stuff like that. Obviously, in the short term, this is not the most cost-effective way for Adidas to make shoes and sell it to you. Instead, they're doing it, and they make a lot of profit as well, in the long term.
But
it still makes profit. Then, if we take Adidas as an example and Run for the Oceans as an example, then is the purpose of the company just to make profit, or is it just something more than just that? Adidas made profit, but it served the environment as well.
Well, I mean, a cynic, and I am definitely a cynic, would say that maybe they're doing that just to sort of get one step ahead of the game.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
I mean, we've seen this with Nike as well. I've just recently seen they've launched a range of hijabs.
Yeah.
Like, just basically, just like black headscarf, but just with a Nike tick on the side. And you're thinking, are they just trying to get in the market early?
Yeah.
To make more money, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, in the cynical world that we live in, let's just not be idealist or, you know, too dreamy about the world that we live in. All companies are there for profit. Yeah. Mm. And the thing is, what is the actual purpose in itself? Is the profit being run at all costs? Or are you considering other stuff as well while your main objective is the profit? For example, If you're going purely for profit, then you're going to disregard not just the environment and your, what effect your company has on the society in general as a, because of you making that profit, but it comes into generally stating whether, you know, are you going to uphold issues with regards to the employment rights, giving bonuses, and stuff like that. I mean, it extends internally as well. If you see from a purely maximization thing, the only figures that you see is profit margin.
Mm.
So how does that make a company efficient? That's a very big question mark that hasn't been answered yet.
Well, it seems like a very grey area, doesn't it?
Yeah. I suppose it kind of is the question, not necessarily whether greed is good, but whether greed is not necessarily bad.
And that extends to what the law actually recognises as the corporate objective in itself.
Mm. And so that obviously brings us on to your research. So, I mean, would you like to maybe give us a bit of an outline as to what the law is at the moment and how your research sort of fits in with?
Well, absolutely. So my research deals primarily with how corporate law can make shareholders a bit more active in the role as a means of enhancing accountability.
Okay.
Accountability in corporate governance. Now, A, what is accountability in corporate governance? B, what is corporate governance in the first place? And C, why do we need accountability?
Yeah.
So, in order to determine all these, we need to identify first what corporate governance is about. We don't have a very solid definition, but the most accurate definition was given by the Capital Committee 28 years ago. And it stated that it's the system of rules that deals primarily with the functioning of the company, how the company is controlled, for what purpose it is controlled, how you achieve good business ethics, and how the law can achieve, can influence all of the foregoing. In doing so, we have what is meant by control and what is meant by accountability as well.
Right, that's quite interesting that good business ethics is kind of included at the bottom level of it, or in the definition of corporate governance.
Most of the times they do, because the material stuff that you gotta think of corporate governance as a very big thing, that corporate law is just one piece of the pie. Yeah,
right.
If you see from other disciplines, you will see that the discipline of management is looking at corporate governance as a means of making management more efficient. Making management more efficient serves a purpose. What's that purpose? Yeah? So most of the disciplines that deal with the corporation and businesses in general have to ask that very same question. What is control? What is accountability? Why we need control standards? Why we need accountability? And that extends to corporate law as well. If you don't have the laws of providing some sanctioning or upholding a certain principle that will deal with the business ethics and stuff like that, then how are you going to do that if you don't know what control and accountability is in the first place?
Yeah. How far does corporate law and business ethics go? Because I was quite astounded when I went to a talk on by an arms manufacturer, strangely enough. It's a bit of a weird link. But basically their consideration of ethics went only as far as engineering ethics, which is like, don't sleep with your co-workers and make sure you have diverse work teams.
Which is ironic. Deeply sort of unsettling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Think about
so
it.
The fact that that's as far as they'll go with ethical considerations, but is good business ethics in terms of corporate governance, is it as shallow as that, or is it more detailed in the way most people would want?
Again, there is this big debate that we have just touched upon, like with profit maximization and whether the company should sell something more than just profit maximization. I mean, there is this neoclassical theory saying that profit maximization is the utmost purpose of the corporation.
Yeah.
And through that, it serves its own public purpose. Yeah? Like the wealth of nations. Well, through the time, economics, accounting, law even, has come to the conclusion that maybe this is not the purpose that we want from corporations, especially when they get big. Because when corporations get big and we have big public companies exercising function, their own failings because of pursuing pure profit maximization affect so many people. It's not just the shareholders that are going to suffer if there is a loss of the company or if a company goes bust. you see a number of creditors, like banks.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the 2008 financial crisis that affected the UK as well tremendously. You see employees, employee pension funds are now shareholders.
Mm.
And you see the environment, and you see the effect that it makes after a company crashes. See Carillion, for example.
Mm. Yeah, it's a big one. I mean, it's quite, it was such a large employer that it kind of created quite a scar on the UK unemployment figures, I guess. And
yeah.
most recently, there's a TV show about hospitals in Liverpool, and there's a massive hospital in Liverpool that was being built by Carillion.
Yeah.
And it's now unfinished.
And all the knock-on for the small businesses as well. Yeah. Like, so small businesses are like builders who lost out on contracts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or who are owed loads of money.
Yeah.
But then don't get paid.
Yeah. So is the proposal of the company, especially when it gets big, just to keep making profit? Possibly not.
But a lot of the people at the top would probably say it is.
Right? Yes. Because so far, economics, management, and the law has taught people like that.
Mm.
Traditionally, if you see the history through time, you bestowed the whole control of the corporation to the directors of the company, quite rightfully so, because they are capable in managing companies, yeah?
Mm.
But you have bestowed that control of the corporation without sufficient accountability. And that comes with accountability as well. In order to define what accountability should be, you need to outline what control should be first. And you control the company for what purpose? We don't know. We think it's create profit maximization, but we see the effects now.
And when you say accountability as well, I mean, this sort of links in with some of my own research. It means accountable to who? Is it supposed to be the workers, shareholders, as you say, or do people like us, as sort of citizens, citizen stakeholders, as it were, sort of accountability?
You mentioned a very nice thing. To whom are you going to keep accountable? Yeah? Are you going to keep the control accountable to the company itself? The company is a separate legal personality.
Mm.
Yeah? Are you going to keep directors accountable to the shareholders? Why are you going to keep them to the shareholders? What are shareholders to the company? We don't know. The law has not provided an answer in regards to what is the role of shareholders in corporate law. Never. Mm-hmm. We went at tremendous lengths in explaining the corporate legal personality for God knows how many years. We have went at great lengths in determining the rights of shareholders and the rights of directors in the company in that separate legal personality, but we have not dealt extensively with what is the role of the director, why would the director control the company, or what is the role of shareholders in the company. There are just assumptions.
Right.
There are just assumptions. There is the assumption that a shareholder is the owner, is the owner of the corporation, which is a complete lie. It's false by so many means.
Mm.
There is the conception that shareholders do not own anything, because pretty much the corporation is just the hub of too many contracts created, that, you know, the effects of all these contracts create an entity called the company, which corporate law calls it as a separate legal personality. And there are other theories saying that, oh, it's a corporate legal personality that is controlled by somebody who is the director. We have no clear answer on anything, pretty much.
Right, so kind of the entire...
The entire system is based on a number of assumptions.
And those assumptions are starting to unravel.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's kind of the point of your research, really.
Yes.
Yeah.
So are you essentially saying there's not enough regulation?
In order to make any regulation, you need to find a purpose, a scope, a principle.
Mm.
We have, so far, corporate legal regulators, academics, or anything like that, have done a very bad job in determining what these purposes are. We just know that there is a principle called the shareholder primacy, as in, for some reason, which we don't know, the shareholder is the principal and the director is the agent of that shareholder for the reasons of control, because shareholders hold the control and delegate it to the directors through the articles of association.
Yeah.
But we don't know why shareholders are having that power of control and delegation in the first place.
Mm.
And the directors of the company, under Section 172 of the UK Companies Act, have the right to control the company, but they should control it in a way that it will serve the best interest of the company, but its members as well. As in, you run the company to make more money for the shareholders.
Yeah.
Mm.
The good thing with the 172 is that it is putting some considerations on other stakeholders as well, like the employees, the environment, society in general, etc., etc. But the first thing that comes in place is shareholders themselves, which comes with it underpins the principle of pure profit maximization, as in you run the company to make more money for the shareholders.
I was wondering here if you differentiate between different types of shareholders. The reason I say this is because you've got these sort of big corporate investment companies, like these pension schemes that will own large amounts of shares, or people who work in business. But then you've got sort of the man and woman on the street who might own a dozen shares, a couple of shares, just for the sake of owning a share. They won't get any return on a dividend. A dividend won't really mean anything to them. Is there a difference between the different sort of types of shareholders or people that might have a sort of stake in the business, do you think?
Well, there are a number of types of shareholders, quite rightfully so. My research principally deals with shareholders that have direct control and shareholder rights. Yeah. When it comes to shareholder rights, most shareholding ownership that has these rights comes from institutional shareholders.
Yes.
So companies own companies own shares from other companies.
Yeah, who are themselves interested in money.
Yeah, are themselves interested in money, but not necessarily. We now have shareholders being classical institutions like pension funds, banks, private funds, or anything like that, that, you know, the everyday person may have a certain percentage in that institutional company. You may have invested in that company for that company to invest in another company. Yeah. We also have pension funds, as in your pension is being regulated by a shareholder of the company. But you also now have many NGOs holding shares as well. Run the Oceans campaign was actually initiated by one shareholder of Adidas.
Right, and they were an NGO?
Yeah.
Right, wow.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So that's...
Tesla as well is being owned by... Well, is being owned. They own shares by a number of NGOs.
So is that an emerging trend, kind of campaigning groups buying shares in order to influence big players?
The whole institutional shareholding trend is quite recent with regards to, you know, the life cycle that we have the company with us so far.
Right.
It started in 1970s, but it has intensified over the past 20 years. Now, over the past 10 years, we see all these institutional shareholders moving away from the traditional I don't care passive investor who only cares about taking money, and we see them intervening all the time.
Right, okay.
And we see them intervening not just for pure profit purposes, but sometimes we see them intervening for making companies more socially responsible. For example, I think it was in British Petroleum, if I'm not mistaken. In British Petroleum, shareholders demanded more information from directors of the company for you know, the environmental effect that the business activities were conducting on the environment. Like, what is the effect?
Right, so we see not just sort of NGOs buying shares up for the intention of changing corporate behavior.
You see even private institutions that care about money caring about social responsibility.
Right.
This is not because they have turned a new leaf and everybody is socially concerned. It's because they now know that if they are socially concerned, they make more money.
Mm. Well, the environment is a sort of money-making...
It's a money-making business as well, anyway.
Yeah, you can kind of put a green sticker on many products and charge extra for it, can't you?
Yeah, but you also send a message.
And what is the message?
The company is more environmentally friendly.
And so because it's more environment friendly, then you think it's a good company and then you're more likely to buy things from it.
Well,
is that the idea?
It comes again with the idea of what is the standard that the law provides in order to be more socially responsible. If the law recognizes that the sole purpose of the company is just for making more money,
yeah,
then the standard of social responsibility that any shareholder or any director of the company or any other person associated with the company deals with it is subject to their own intentions. There is no principle whatsoever. That's why Carillion's directors don't have a lot of backlash under Article 172. They did the jobs perfectly. We made actions that we thought they were being done for making more money for the shareholders, and we took regard to other stakeholders as well. Nothing wrong with that.
They just weren't very good at business.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess kind of the point we're getting to is you know, we're seeing shareholders, whether they're NGOs or private individuals, pushing companies to do things for the common good because they just happen to also make money or make more money.
Yeah.
Do you think there's kind of any scope for shareholders shareholders to push for the common good, even if it doesn't make money, even if it's just for other reasons than making money?
Well, this is a very good question. That extends to another thing. Are you going to impose in law a responsibility on shareholders in pursuing the common good, even if it doesn't make money?
Yeah.
So that's a very tricky question. That's one of the questions that I'm dealing with right now. As in order for the shareholder to engage in any activity whatsoever, as in being more active and stuff like that, he's not going to do it on its own.
Yeah? Yeah.
He holds a very small percentage in the company, and on its own, that percentage, however big it is insignificant in terms of making changes. It has to bring other shareholders to the table as well to make a big collective action that it has a significant amount of the shareholding voting right percentage that can make changes to the company through the exercise of that power, whatever that power is. In the UK, for example, the rights of shareholders with regards to powers are tremendous in comparison to the US or in Germany. So it comes with issues related to, can they do it? Will they do it? Do they have the means of doing it?
Right, okay.
Is there also a conflict of interest, I wonder, in terms of long-term and short-term aims? Because often green initiatives are associated with long-termism, really. And you find maybe shareholders might be disinclined to want to invest in renewable energy sources because of the outlay and the short-term losses.
If they're not going to get their money back.
They're not going to get it back very quickly.
For a long time, yeah.
That's because the whole short-term, long-term, short-term is long-term is coined under this big principle that we call shareholder primacy. Now, in order to provide you an answer on that, you need to know how shareholder primacy was reasoned as a principle in itself. It was the 1970s, and back at then, the top economist in the whole world was Milton Friedman. And in a very nice article, he stated that, as a true believer, he was the father of neoliberalism, and neoliberalism was based on neoclassical theories of economics. Making more money for the shareholders was coined under the terms of profit maximization. And Milton Friedman, unknown that while he didn't know anything about law in itself, provided the idea that, you know, if you're going to run the company, you're going to run it for profit maximization, and that means that you're going to run it for maximizing shareholder profit. That extended to two key main areas, that you make profit for increasing shareholder wealth, as in generate them more dividends, or increase shareholder value in the stock market. Now, there is a very big belief that short-termism is the idea of making more money for shareholders that will increase the value in the stock market in the short term. The long term is the idea that if you take into account other stuff, that increase in value will come in the longer term. And it's coined as a good thing because you take them into account. The reality of that is that the theory of Milton Friedman's of that the correct purpose of the company is to make more money for the shareholders is based on an idea that the market itself can self-correct.
Yeah, so the idea of the guiding hand, the invisible hand guiding the market.
The invisible hand, the efficient capital market hypothesis, you name it. That hypothesis is based on too many assumptions. One of the assumptions is that the market is perfect. There is whatever information is out there that determines the value of companies is good.
Yeah.
In reality, it's not. The second thing is that should it's not, we have this whole arbitrage thing. You can guesstimate the whole value by itself. And it is, again, good. It's as efficient as possible. There is good indication as to why this is not the case, because many people in the market are irrational. Nobody is rational enough.
Yeah, this is kind of the thing that a lot of quite a few people are talking about recently, that most of economic theory is based on rational actors and people generally aren't rational.
People don't do rational things.
Yes, no, people exactly. don't do rational things, and the same should extend to business. Why would, for example, in order to determine if a short-term thing is in comparison good to a long-term thing, you need to see the horizon of a certain investor. Let's say that you two guys are investors. You invest in the same company, Company A, for example, and you plan on being in that company for 1 month, and you plan to be in the company for 1 year.
Yeah.
Now, your plans, yeah, even if you make a law, as in the new Shareholders' Rights Directive, say, to make a report on how you can, how, you know, your own actions are going to serve in the long term, they're going, you're going to make a report based on how it's going to affect your long-term returns in 1 month, and how it's going to affect the long term of your returns in 1 year.
So
there is a big difference. If you coin it as a long-term thing, you can readily identify whether it's going to affect in a positive way the company or not. Yeah, it's being based on value. Measuring stuff on value and creating corporate governance rules based on value is not advisable. You're not helping in actually identifying what is the right standard that companies should undertake.
And I suppose value itself has a range of different definitions. Mm.
Philosophically, yes.
Because it's not just, is it then, are we just experiencing a change in culture? Is that essentially what we're...
Yeah. Jean Godillard, for example, provides, you know, a very nice philosophical debate of what is value. And if you come and think of it, it extends to the value in economics. How is the stock market exchange and the values in that whole thing, Bloomberg, you see, all the figures and stuff like that is determined? I'll give you a very good example. The share price of Tesla has raised because of one tweet.
Yeah. I guess that's
how rational is that? Why would the good of the company be determined by one tweet?
Yeah, for the people who don't follow Elon Musk on Twitter.
Yeah, and why you should regulate corporate law in accordance with that idea. It's a market, yeah? There is a reason for that market to be there, and I'm okay with it, yeah? It serves capitalism in its own way, but is that the prime thing that we should focus on upon regulating companies and how good we want our companies to be in the next 100 years?
So it leaves us with a lot to think about, I think, doesn't it?
Absolutely does, yeah.
Because, I mean, we're just getting towards the end now of our interview. I mean, do you have any sort of summary thoughts? I mean, where are you at with your project at the moment?
At the moment, I'm in the process of completing my own thoughts. And my conclusion to this is that if you want to actually regulate corporate governance in any way, whether you're believing that shareholders have a role in the corporate governance or not, or whether you believe that directors should not be bothered with anybody, that's fine. But what we really need to answer and start answering is fundamental concepts related to what control is, what accountability is, and what we want from our companies in the next years. Then we can talk about regulation of rights.
Right. And is that... Or have you got any ideas about where you want kind of this whole situation to go?
According to my own ideas and stuff like that, I believe that pure profit maximization is not the way to go. I think that, especially for big companies, there is this whole thing, this social contract that exists between the company and the society in general, not just the state.
So you've mentioned social contract, which is, and it links to something Mike and I have spoken about a few times, about whether companies and corporations are becoming as powerful or more powerful than states in some areas.
Mm. Well, they do.
Yeah.
If you come and see a bit, you know, see the whole Google hearings. The state, the prime element of regulation and determination and adjudication and stuff like that, had no idea what they were doing with the CEO of Google. Actually, the CEO of Google was, you know, pretty much doing a show there, explaining them stuff, and the judges, the representatives and senators of the whole US government had no idea what they were talking about.
Yeah, I suppose
so
you can
also... So how powerful is that?
You, I suppose you can also see with Mark Zuckerberg, kind of he denied or declined to turn up at several instances where he could have explained himself and Facebook to lawmakers across the world. I think there was actually a grand inquiry about MPs from about seven different countries, and Facebook could have declined to turn up or send.
And you should not always see Facebook as the bad big thing that happened with the scandals and stuff like that. You should see the other side as well. As you know, as soon as they found out about the incident, they tried to correct it.
Well, actually, I was reading something today actually about Facebook, and this. I think it was a guy who used to kind of, he referred to himself as the mentor of Mark Zuckerberg and was a, sort of an angel investor right at the start, and sort of said that when it comes to scandals at Facebook, you know, when a scandal emerges, Facebook just denies, pretends it never happened, and then when it kind of, it's they can't cope with denying it anymore, they kind of say, oh, we've dealt with it now, and they apologise, and but they never really do anything. They just kind of leave everything, every scandal.
Yeah,
the causes of every scandal they just leave to go.
That's
on.
Like with every scandal that occurs in the corporate sector, like see BHS for example.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah. But BHS is just on a totally different level. I mean, never before have we had a case where a company's got like a sixth of the world's population signed up to it.
Yep,
and like, as users, as stakeholders.
Yeah, I mean, he's providing internet to
see,
millions
Volkswagen
of the poor.
See Volkswagen. Volkswagen was denying everything up until it couldn't deny it.
Yeah,
yeah. All these instances have one thing in common. And that thing in common is that they do bad behavior. How that could be my concluding remark. How do you regulate bad behavior?
Well, this is something that I've been thinking about recently, actually, because you kind of see, when you see a company do something bad, they apologize, act like they're doing something to stop it, but they don't really deal with the systematic issues that cause the bad behavior.
Yeah.
In much the same way that in society, you know, if we see somebody or if we hear about a celebrity say something offensive, whatever it might be. Quite often, kind of, there's a Twitter mob that try and you know, discredit them in every way, but they don't deal with the fact that maybe the person has offensive views or and why that is, and so it never really deals with the issues
because they'll just come back and be offensive again somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what corporate governance should have done. Is, you know, corporate governance should have been the rules upon which you regulate companies in fixing systematic failures. Or preventing them, or at least preventing them. There is this whole sort of debate as well as to what type of corporate governance do we want. Do we want kind of like an American one where you prescribe everything on how you want to do it?
Right.
Or do you create the principles upon which the companies are free to do it?
Right, okay.
It's difficult though, isn't it? Because very early on in our conversation, now we're going a little bit off piste here, but I wrote down the difference between the law as written and the law as intended.
Yeah.
Because I mean, if you think about tax law, I'm thinking about Amazon, Starbucks, all these other big companies. They're not breaking any laws.
Yeah.
But in the minds of the people, they're doing wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they assume that because they operate here, they should be paying a certain amount of tax.
Yeah.
Same in Carillion. They didn't do anything wrong in terms of law unless there are some indications of insider dealing. I think that is still under consideration, if I'm not mistaken. But in terms of corporate governance, they didn't do anything wrong.
But it's a matter of perception, then, isn't it?
It's a matter of perception. Yeah. And again, it comes, you know, a thing that my supervisors keep telling me all the time, and I was willfully delaying it up until recently, it's a highly political problem as well.
Mm.
It comes with the understanding of what our politicians think of what corporate governance is and what the purpose of the company is. That comes again, you know, you see it from the politics side, but again, it revolves the same kind of questions. What is the purpose of the company in the first place? So if you can't provide the right answer on that, or if you don't know what the right answer is for that, or at least you have some evidence of what the right answer is for that, then how are you going in the first place to do any laws that will uphold principles that are effective in minimizing bad behavior? Because you cannot eliminate bad behavior.
So I suppose, kind of in a concluding kind of summing up way, we can kind of say. That it's really difficult to regulate companies and the whole notion of corporate governance is difficult to implement because no one's really sure what the point of it is.
Exactly. And all the debates around the role of shareholders in companies or what directors should do in companies willfully neglect these kind of issues, because not willfully neglect, they either assume that there are some issues, there are some principles that these are and there is nothing else, but many times they clearly do assumptions just for the sake of arguing. Nothing else, nothing more.
Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit InTheZonePodcast.com.